Thank you, Monica. So it is May 7th, 2024. And Tuesday, as usual. And I am Kevin Griffin, and we're going to meditate for a little while before we talk about various topics. And I'm kind of more focused on meditation today, although I think I generally have this class has become more and more just more meditation oriented. I do always try to make those connections with recovery in case, just so that we don't get lost from that. All right, so let's start. I'm gonna keep a little bit of an eye on the waiting room. Since there may still be a few people haven't arrived yet. Excuse me for a moment while I. So yeah, we begin with about 20 minutes of meditation. So I will give a little bit of instruction and guidance for that, and then let you sit with yourself, such as yourself might be. Beginning by just stabilizing your posture. If you're sitting, then being upright, and you can close your eyes or just lower your gaze, taking the attention out of the visual realm. And starting by just feeling how you're holding your body. Are you comfortable, or is there any awkwardness, any adjustments to make? And feeling the body breathing, just very naturally, not controlling the breath, just being aware of how the breath moves in the body. And having a sense of just settling with the body, relaxing even as you stay bright and alert, letting go of any tension in the shoulders, the belly, anywhere that you hold stress in the body. I like to sort of imagine that my whole body is being drawn towards the earth, even though I'm holding the spine erect. So there's a kind of releasing, letting go through the body. Draining away of any tension, any stress. Just letting the breath naturally calm and settle the body. And the calming of the body naturally calms the mind. And we're not trying to stop thinking or clamp down the mind, but not to be caught up, not to let ourselves just drift off into daydreams. Or planning or memories, allowing thoughts to move through the mind, even as we feel the body and the breath here now. And you might then attune to the more subtle feeling realm, which is still connected to the body, a kind of bridge between mind and body. Breathing into the feelings, just allowing them as well to just come and go, to flow through. There's a kind of balance between being very grounded in the body and a kind of soft touch with the mind, not suppressing mental activity, but not being swept up in it. The body awareness helps us to maintain this kind of attitude. The body is made up of the elements, earth and water. Fire, air. These physical elements. The mind doesn't have these more solid aspects. And we want in meditation to have a sense of spaciousness, of the openness of the mind. And so being grounded in the body balances that openness so that we don't just drift off. It's almost as if we are standing on the earth and looking into deep space, the deep space of mind, never forgetting that our feet are on the earth. The guiding principle of our practice is letting go. So we don't get attached to either the earth or the space. We are present, aware. There's no grasping or clinging, just a clear, bright attention, watching the evolving experience of mind and body. All right, good morning again. Before I embark on the sort of some of the themes I wanted to explore today, I'll talk a little bit about what this I call it a class is about. And really just a moment, because about what I do, and many of you, most of you already know this, but just to clarify, because I think, I hear from people from time to time. People find my website and email me sort of out of the blue, which is nice. There can be this expectation that I'm offering a program, a recovery program, and that's not really how I view what I'm offering, but rather that I'm trying to more offer enhancement to your recovery program and whatever it might be. I mean, I got sober in AA. Other people get sober in other ways. Recovery Dharma is sort of a popular Buddhist approach to recovery. I know also that sometimes newcomers come and work with the things that I offer, and they get some benefit from that. But I guess my point is that I'm sort of aiming more to an audience that's already got some of the fundamentals of recovery established and is trying to build on that. And I, certainly believe that the Dharma, the Buddha Dharma, offers us tools and teachings that can really profoundly affect our lives and improve ultimately our recovery process, deepen it. So that's kind of my lengthy, explanation. In any case, I want to start with something that our dear member Abigail sent me yesterday, and I want to see if I can find this the link she sent, because we can put this into the chat. So this was an interview with a famous scientist who does research into the effect of meditation. This was the Harvard graduate study. What's it called? It's the blah 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 Graduate School of Arts and Sciences, and it's an interview with someone named Paul Massari. And some of it's very standard stuff that, if you're familiar with Richard Davidson, he's been at the University of Wisconsin in Madison for a long time, and collaborated with the Dalai Lama since he says he first met him in 1992. And the thing that the Dalai Lama asked him is, you're always studying all the negative things that happen in the mind, right? And the mental illness. Why don't you ever study like compassion and, mindfulness? And since Davidson was already a meditator, he was inspired by that. When the Dalai Lama suggests you do something, I guess it's like, okay, maybe I'll do that. And so and I'm sure most of you have heard about the studies of the Tibetan monks and, showing how their happiness centers in their brains are so light up a lot more than ordinary people. But it also, but his studies also showed that even small amounts of meditation can be really beneficial. I actually printed out this article. I'm like Donald Trump, printing out the internet. I did that actually because I wanted to highlight some parts of it and take it with me. I'm teaching a retreat this week, so a few things out of here, and then I'm gonna draw from some other teachings today. So I am step. I'm not continuing right now. I'm not doing the More Than Mindfulness book, which is what we've been covering for a while, but we'll come back to it for sure. So there's kind of a question about what meditation is. He says, meditation represents a family of exercises that involve the intentional use of our mental capacities to improve our well-being and to nurture human flourishing. Yeah, that's kind of a nice little explanation. So here we have classified meditation into at least three broad families of practice. One we call awareness practices, and that's where mindfulness kind of practices would be. The second we call deconstructive practices. I'm going to come back to this. The most important prototype for this is a kind of meditation that, for example, is most commonly done by the Dalai Lama, but actually has received very little scientific attention. And it's what we call analytic meditation, where through reasoning, there is a deconstruction of the self, if you will. One example of that is the sentence that people might commonly use when they might say, I'm in pain. If you use that sentence when you say, I'm in pain, what does that actually mean? Who is the I in this sentence? And does it mean that all of you is in pain, every cell in your body? And so what does it mean to say something like that? Or with an emotion, when we say, I'm sad, what does that actually mean? And what is the I in that sentence? So reflecting on that is really beneficial. And that's a deconstructive practice. As I say, I have more to say about this, but the third category is constructive practice, actually generating a specific kind of emotion. The principle, the prototype for that is compassion meditation, where you're actively and intentionally generating this quality of compassion. So it could be kindness, but one of these virtuous emotions. So, yeah, I think that, the one and three, the awareness practice and the compassion practice are things that we hear more about. And obviously loving kindness is falls under that constructive practice. And there's more to say about a lot more to say about the awareness practices, but I want to talk a little bit about the deconstructive practice, because I think it is a really interesting area to explore. And it, because it particularly brought up something I was doing in my recent retreat, and those of you who have been with me the last few months, you've noticed that as one does, and if you go on a long retreat, you'll find that you often, over months and months, you'll keep finding yourself referring back to an experience like that. I was on a 6-week retreat in the fall, and different things come to mind in the ensuing months and the following months. So I was working with the Sutta on Mindfulness of Breathing, the Anapanasati Sutta, and the last aspect of that sutta is basically a deconstructive practice. Contemplating impermanence, contemplating what's called fading away, which is fading away of passion, contemplating cessation, which has multiple meanings, contemplating letting go. So just the term contemplating already tells us that we're taking a different stance. In most of that sutta and most of the guidance we get in meditation, and particularly in awareness practices, which we would generally call anapanasati, is about experiencing. And in the Anapanasati Sutta, the term experiencing shows up a lot, experiencing the breath, experiencing the body. experiencing feelings, experiencing the mind. But this last section of the sutta turns toward contemplation, which is more of a reflective or intentional thinking. And so I was actually, what I was doing with that practice, which can really, you need a foundation of concentration to do this, first of all. Step back a little bit. If we just start to think about this stuff, our mind will tend to just proliferate. But when you're well concentrated on a retreat, or it doesn't have to be a retreat, it could be, and of course we do this kind of reflection when we're taking a walk in the woods, or sitting on the in the backyard, just sort of taking it easy, that we can find ourselves reflecting on these things. But to do it in a more concentrated state, then you can do it in a very intentional way and maintain, kind of keep yourself on track, because it's very easy when doing a contemplation on impermanence to find your mind just kind of running off, right? Like, oh, I'm going to think about impermanence. Oh, man, everything. Oh, man, I'm getting old. Oh, man, God, oh, I really need to call the doctor. Oh, what am I going to do about that? So the mind easily wanders, right? But if we're well concentrated, so I would do a reflection where I would, just reflect. My body is impermanent, and then I would think about the different aspects of my body that I know have changed over time. And then feelings are impermanent, and I would reflect on just the different feelings. And well, a lot of this I was actually doing in real time. My body is impermanent, and I would just feel the energetic quality, the way the body is vibrating. It's not a solid thing. When you tune in, feelings are impermanent. I would just feel my emotions and how they were like. There's this always this kind of flow going on. The mind is impermanent, and so and then cessation and or fading away, and so it was just as Davidson is talking about here. I would kind of unpeel and point my mind toward these questions of what does that mean? What does cessation meaning mean? And part of this was informed by some commentary that I had read on these different aspects, particularly from Venerable Inalio. So and I'll say, as he suggests, the classic deconstruction is the deconstruction of self, right? Of I, that's who am I? This is actually, I think that's a Advaita Vedanta Hindu practice as well. So just to put that out there, I'm not suggesting that you should spend all your time doing this, but I think it's helpful, like at the end of a if you're doing a longer sit or on a retreat, to occasionally take some time and do these kind of intentional deconstructive practices, take things apart. When I do the daily reflections in my daily sit, which include, I am of the nature to age, to sicken, and to die, occasionally I will go through particularly those first two very carefully, and I will reflect. Like to sicken is interesting, and I go through the different parts of my body and the different ways that they've been sick at some point. Like I've had ear infections, I've had eye infections, I've had sinus infections, I've had canker sores, my teeth have been had holes in them, moving down the body. I've had my lungs have been sick. I've had heart problems. I've been sick and had to throw up at times. Every part of my body, to reflect on all the parts of my body that have gotten ill over my lifetime, just as a reminder that this is not my body. I'm not in control of this. These are the things that happen. I am of the nature to age, to think about how the different parts of my body are aging. You know, well, up here, my hair, my hearing is fading, my eyes are weakening, you know, my teeth are falling out, et cetera, et cetera. I know it's a very happy, happy reflection. It always cheers me up. Yeah, not at all. Nonetheless, I think these are valuable things to do with our practice from time to time, not as a constant thing at all. All right, a couple other things from this article, and then I think I'm going to have time to move on to the other topic I want to get into. So the question, do these different kinds of meditations, broadly speaking, affect the brain differently? This is, I know a lot of people are into this science stuff with the meditation. So to give a high-level summary, awareness practices and focused attention and concentration practices mostly affect systems in the brain that are concerned with the regulation of attention. Well, that makes sense, right? Regulating attention, having instead of our mind just like blah blah going off all the time, actually being able to like, oh wait, I'm going to stay on topic here. The deconstructive practices are going to affect the default mode of the brain. This is the mode of brain function that has been linked to self-referential thought. So you're noticing selfing, noticing how you're thinking about yourself, and not being so caught up in that. It's valuable. The constructive practices, particularly compassion and kindness, will activate positive emotional centers in the brain and also activate, to some extent, perspective-taking areas of the brain that also are involved in empathy. I hope that is clear what that means. I think most folks in the question see meditation as a practice when someone will just with immense willpower is somehow able to clear their mind of thoughts. Can you speak to that popular notion? Yeah, that is a complete myth and stereotype. Meditation does not involve requiring in any way getting rid of thoughts. Human minds and brains, at least in large part, are there to produce thoughts. The goal of meditation is not to get rid of thoughts at all. Even the greatest meditation masters, and we've been lucky to study some of them in our laboratory, have thoughts. So meditation may involve changing our relationship to thoughts, but it doesn't involve getting rid of thoughts. Well, and as I like to say, you know, look at the Pali Canon, the thousands of pages of teachings from the Buddha. He must have been thinking if he figured all this stuff out. It didn't just like pop out of his mouth. Here's a very interesting thing. He talks about Judson Brewer. He found that it's another researcher. He found that short moments of mindfulness many times a day actually were more effective for changing his patient's unhealthy habits, if anybody has any of those, than a traditional meditation practice. How have you in your research found the same? Yeah, I would strongly agree with Judd. I think that's a very important insight. And we have found that particularly in beginning practitioners, doing really short periods of practice several times a day is much more effective in producing desirable long-term outcomes. So I think this is a really interesting point. And, you know, to me, what he's talking about is daily mindfulness, which is different from meditation because I think it's quite true, especially for someone who hasn't inculcated the teachings deeply and doesn't have like a practice that kind of kicks in at moments, that just having an intentional like, oh, let me stop and take a breath or take three breaths, you know, multiple times a day, you know, and even ritualizing that, like when I get in my car, before I start the car, I breathe, you know, when I step outside, I stop and I breathe, when I, you know, when I answer the phone, I take a breath before I answer the phone. These kind of small moments, I think, are very helpful because, you know, to meditate for 20 minutes in the morning, it's not like a, you know, 24-hour drug that then like carries you through. It's a good way to start. It gets you on track, but it's this returning. Here's another great comment. People in public talks that I give, people often ask, what's the best form of meditation that I could do? And I'll say, the best form of meditation that you could do is the form of meditation that you actually do. Which is a lot like recovery, if we get back to that. Show up. There, it's not going to be perfect. There's no like ideal way. It's like just keep showing up. Okay. Oh, my fault. Yeah, just a little more I've highlighted here. Since it is Mental Health Awareness Month, I want to talk about anxiety and depression, and the impact of meditation and mindfulness as a treatment for them. How does it really compare to the standard pharmacology? My reading of the data is that it's basically comparable in terms of its impact on, for example, the symptoms of anxiety and depression. What's different is that it has fewer side effects.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is interesting how he talks about this. So this is the idea of taking medication versus meditation. And I'm not here to tell anybody that they shouldn't be taking medication for their mental health, because I've done that at various times. I did not care for it, but at times when I felt I was really needed to break out of a really strong period of intense period of depression. The problem for me being that the psychiatrist never wants you to stop, and it's very hard to stop. And anyway, this is interesting. He uses this terminology, strength-based approach versus deficit-based approach. He says, there's some reason to think that strength-based approaches rather than deficit-based approaches may ultimately be better for treating anxiety and depression, because there's a lot of reason to believe that many of the skills which are important to flourishing are actually innate. And so strengthening them and cultivating them makes more sense than simply treatments to get rid of the symptoms. Is that clear what he's talking about? Yeah, it's interesting, right? It's like meditation to cultivate these qualities that work with and deal with stuff and move you towards wholesome and positive states, rather than I'm going to take a drug to suppress the negative, the symptoms. Finally, he says some really interesting things about psychedelics. The question is, there's a lot of excitement about the use of psychedelics. From what I've read, the experience of taking something like MDMA or psilocybin sounds a lot like the way some people describe what it's like when they meditate, which begs the question, do psychedelics and meditation affect the brain in the same way? There's some research on a mechanistic level looking at the brain, which has found some similarities, but also some differences in how they might work. In my view, the application of psychedelics to the treatment of specific disorders is different than the application of psychedelics to people who don't have a frank disorder and who otherwise might be interested in meditation. So it basically says there's a difference between using it for a medicinal kind of purpose and using it for a spiritual experience. We know that the nature of a psychedelic experience is at least in part a function of the guide or facilitator that one has. And just like in meditation, receiving instruction from a really experienced practitioner is very different from receiving instruction for someone who just took an MBSR course. And so the training of these psychedelic guides is a serious issue. I think it is really interesting he brings this up. There's an article about the problem in trying to train people, and they're using holotropic breath work as a way to train people. What we're seeing today is a proliferation of these money-making one-year programs, various places around the country, to train psychedelic guides who had otherwise very little experience, and that frightens me, to be honest. A second concern is that meditation, this is where I really go with this. A second concern is that meditation is not about the experience we have when we're meditating. We can have all kinds of experiences when we're meditating. We can have blissful experiences. We can also have really difficult experiences. And sometimes those really difficult experiences end up being as important, if not more important, than the blissful experiences. And it's not about the experience. Psychedelics produce really dramatic experiences. And often people get very focused on the experience. And people who've had a psychedelic experience often want to recreate that experience. But it really is not about the experience. It's not going to help you become a kinder person. And those are the measures ultimately which matter, at least to him. Does your spouse think you're nicer and you're more cooperative and more altruistic? Both meditation and psychedelics in their original form as plant-based medicine, in their psychedelic case, embedded in indigenous. Okay, there's some. Something wrong. Were, I'm sorry, were embedded in indigenous contexts and the meditation in religious and spiritual contexts, both of which have an ethical container. And I think that this ethical framework is really important and is an active ingredient in the beneficial effects that these might have. Really interesting. And I think you've heard me say some similar things, particularly about the container. That and the idea of like getting attached to the experience, and we know about being attached to experiences. And I got in trouble for talking about, I got in trouble, but someone objected to my negative take on psychedelics recently. So I am trying to be more open about learning about them and their value. Without having sort of a knee-jerk response, but obviously I'm also really like looking because I think it's a high-risk route. I'm always looking at like, can I what are the issues? And he brings those up. Having a guide, not getting attached to experiences, and having an ethical framework. Why are we doing things? And the thing about recovery is that it's an ethically based approach, even though we don't usually start in recovery out of a longing to be more, morally responsible and ethical. Once you step into this world, we realize it's not just about not using intoxicants. It's also about don't lie, cheat, and steal, because that's tied in with the addictive behavior. Addiction is more than just this physical thing that happens where you have some effect from some substance that makes you feel a certain way. It's tied in with the whole way of thinking. The idea that I'm gonna latch on to this experience and do it so that I can have this pleasant state, or just I'm going to control my mind state and get away from it. It's very self-centered. It's very selfish inherently. And it devolves into, abandoning ethical behavior because the self demands what the self wants and doesn't care about the impact that it has on the rest of the world, And so this is, if we don't adopt at some point, not necessarily when we enter into recovery, but in the process of recovery, if we don't adopt a broader ethical framework, we're not really taking on this process of recovery. We're just like, we want to fix ourselves so that we can then continue on in our selfish way of living. That's not recovery in my mind. It might be sobriety. And this again goes back to Buddhism and how the foundation of Buddhist practice is ethics. It's not meditation. It's not enlightenment. Before any of that, there's an ethical framework. And just in the same way that in a indigenous religious context, that culminates in a plant medicine ritual, there's an ethical framework for that. It's not just going in to get high or going in even to have some spiritual experience. It's the culmination of something that's got a foundation in ethical living and community living. And so love and compassion are foundation elements for all of this. And the 12 steps point to this as well. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message. Well, that's an act of compassion. It's an act of kindness. It's an act of sacrifice and service. Well, I was going to talk about something else, but I can see that I've used up all my time, so I'm going to put aside my other reference point. Oh, that's interesting. A little comment about Bob says, I think empathetic people have a time of it in this world. My veterans group uses songwriting as a way to heal from combat experiences. It's exploring psychotropics as well. So suicide among veterans is off the charts. Yes, it is. Well, a few minutes left if anybody wants to chime in. I know that kind of covered a lot, and landing on the psychedelics winds up being like maybe not. I didn't mean to make that the point of the whole thing. I thought that the deconstruction meditation was quite interesting, and the division of the awareness and the deconstruction, and then the cultivation practices. Seeing, I think it is very helpful to get a picture of a world we're operating in when we say meditation. It can mean many, many different things, and the other topic I was going to get into is really a deeper exploration of an awareness practice, which is Bhikkhu Anālya's book, The Signless and the Deathless, and signless meditation, which is when you get to the point where you're practicing awareness of the breath and the body and mind, and then eventually those objects kind of fade, and there's just awareness of awareness, just kind of awareness of the space of being. That our practice evolves toward that. So any hand raising you guys can this morning. And yes, Tanya, I see
Hey
you.
everyone. I was typing this and I was like, it's too long. Wait, I called Siri by mistake. Go away, Siri. No, I was just thinking how so much of my recovery, and I'm sure a lot of people relate to this, ha has been about deconstructing that old way of being. You know, I think that we naturally have to do a lot of deconstructing when we get into recovery, you know? And then for me, then there was like a period of limbo. Okay, I've deconstructed, and you know, now what? So I really appreciated that description of the different types of meditation. I feel because yeah, I feel like I've been much more into the third part of kind of not reconstructing, but just sort of being, you know, and of course the compassion and all of those values that I believed in and wanted when I was using, but couldn't grasp, or just wasn't a my disease of addiction wasn't able to let me, you know, flower in those things. And so now, you know, it's a lot of being grateful for being able to do those things now. So that was just my little comment.
Nice. Thank you, Tanya. Yeah, and It's interesting you point out the deconstruction that's inherent in recovery. I mean, we have that expression peeling the onion, which is very much deconstruction. And I think you're right. I think that even like writing an inventory is a deconstructive practice. It's really looking at what was going on, what were the underlying what's the underlying history and movement of the mind in our life that have brought us somewhere, and we have to kind of take it apart. So yeah, that's helpful. Yeah. Oh well, such a quiet group. Where's Steve when I need him? I should mention that Abigail is did I say that you're the person who's pointed me to that article? Yes, I want to definitely, because it's the sort of thing I wouldn't immediately be drawn to it, and I started reading. I was like, oh yeah, this is standard stuff. Yeah, blah blah blah. But then, as the later in the article, these things emerged that I thought were really really interesting. Yeah, if you're interested in that work, look up Richard Davidson, also known as Richie in the for the people who are in the cool kids, call him Richie, and he did a book with Daniel Goleman called Altered Traits, which is quite interesting as well. Well, okay then. I rarely end early, but it's 10, well, 11 o'clock. I just turned over. I'm allowed to end though. So, this Friday, I need to send an email, is the Spirit Rock class. And I'm going to be teaching a retreat in Big Bear, so with Vimala Sara. So Walt Opie is going to lead that class. And then next Tuesday, I will be here from somewhere. Not sure where I'll be that morning, but that evening, I will be at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery. So anybody who is in the Bay Area, it would be great if you came out. I'm restarting this class that obviously I stopped at the beginning of the pandemic, and it'll be on the second Tuesday. Used to be on the fourth Tuesday. Be on the second Tuesday of each month at 7:30 p.m. The Berkeley Buddhist Monastery is at 2304 Berkeley, sorry, McKinley Avenue in Berkeley. The information is on my website. And
I
it's
put it all in
Donna.
chat. I put it
Oh, you
all
did?
in
Good, good.
chat.
And it's that's totally by Donna, just by donation. So there's no fee to get come in, and we'll sit and then connect. So hope to see people there. And otherwise, we'll continue with the Tuesday mornings. Hope everyone will stay safe. And I was going to say safe and sober, but I mean, I know everybody here isn't an alcoholic, so just say maintaining your recovery. Blessings. Bye bye.